12,000 is a very large number. If you drove 12,000 miles from the Hirshhorn, you could go to New York and back 24 times. If 141 Shaquille O'Neals were stacked on top of one another, they would be 12,000 feet tall. 12,000 days is about 33 years. 12,000 is also just about the number of works of art in the Hirshhorn's permanent collection. And 12,000 is approximately the number of pieces John Baldessari had to choose from when he assembled this exhibition, Ways of Seeing, John Baldessari Explores the Collection. The Hirshhorn invited John Baldessari, an American artist whose work is an amalgam of words, photographs, and video imagery, to install works from the museum's nearly 12,000-piece collection. After choosing the 70 works of art you are about to see, Baldessari organized them according to his own personal vision. This exhibition is the first in a new series at the Hirshhorn called Ways of Seeing. The ongoing project will invite noted artists, filmmakers, authors, and others to explore the collection and create installations from their own unique perspectives. When looking at art, everyone brings their own ideas. Personal experiences often affect which art we find interesting or moving, and of course, which art bores or confuses us. The goal of Ways of Seeing is to open up new ways of looking at the Hirshhorn's collection and to enable you to see the art a little bit differently. This guide will spotlight 8 works that I selected based on their potential appeal to other teenagers. As a rising high school senior, I searched for works that deal with issues we might care about or be familiar with, and objects that just looked interesting or weird. This guide also represents my own way of seeing the art in this installation. My interpretations are different from John Baldessari's, and most likely different from yours. The goal of this podcast is to give you a jumping-off point from which you can make your own interpretations about the art in this exhibition. Baldessari once said, "I am concerned with what happens between things and ideas." Many of the works of art John Baldessari chose for this exhibition deal in some way with the idea of betweenness. There are pieces that deal with the space between birth and death, the space between mainstream society and the outskirts of society, and the space between the past and the present. To me, this installation seemed perfect for a teenage audience because, as teenagers, we are also living in the space between. The space between childhood and adulthood. Ideally, you'll be able to download this podcast and listen to it while you're looking at the Ways of Seeing exhibition. If you can't make it to the museum, you can search the Hirshhorn's website for selected images of the works and view some of the photos while listening to the podcast. Ways of Seeing is located on the Hirshhorn's lower level. I hope you enjoy the exhibition and the guide. As John Baldessari said, "I am concerned with what happens between things and ideas." The first work of art you'll see on this tour certainly deals with what happens in between. Specifically, in between life and death. To view this sculpture and begin the audio tour, go down the escalator to the lower level of the Hirshhorn. Once you reach the bottom, turn right and right again to walk toward the far wall. You'll see a life-size cast of a man upside down in front of you. This sculpture is called the Angel of St. Adalbert. Miroslav Balka, the artist of this piece, was inspired by St. Adalbert, the patron saint of Poland. St. Adalbert was a bishop who was murdered in 997 CE when he refused to leave Pomerania, where he was engaged in missionary work. This sculpture depicts the saint caught between life and death. The wooden plank above his body suggests his crucifixion and martyrdom, while the pile of ash on the floor suggests his body after death. The figure of the body itself, parts of which were cast from Balka's own body, floats somewhere in between. Balka, a Polish artist, was very interested in the idea of life and death and the space between them. His grandfather was a mason who built tombstones and funerary monuments. Having grown up with his grandfather, whose job carving tombstones combined art, architecture, death, religion, and the human body, it comes as no surprise that Balka would explore the connections among these things in his own work. Balka became interested in saints and martyrs as a young man. He visited churches often and came to admire saints the way we might admire celebrities or athletes. He combines these two elements of his youth, his interest in saints and his childhood surrounded by tombstones and death, in this 1988 sculpture. You might feel like you can't relate to this sculpture. Most of us don't research the lives of saints for fun or see ourselves becoming one in the future. But Balka left out a face in his sculpture and kept the gender of the figure neutral. Balka may be trying to capture more than just the spirit of St. Adalbert in this piece. He may also be depicting a kind of universal spirit caught between life and death. Balka's sculpture delves into the space between living and dying, and the ambiguity of things we can't see. We never actually see the angel of St. Adalbert in this sculpture. Instead, we see the things he ultimately discarded when he left his body on Earth. You might think it's weird to open an exhibition called Ways of Seeing with a sculpture all about something we can't see. But the space between things and ideas, as Baldessari called them, are always invisible to the eye. The art here aims to give you a new way of looking at things you already know by forcing you to examine the space between them and how they relate to one another. The second work of art on the tour displays another headless figure. If you walk into the exhibit and turn right, you'll see a painting of a fragmented torso on the far wall. This painting is called Delusions of Grandeur 2 by René Magritte. In this painting, created in 1948, Magritte has taken something classical and turned it into something new and different. Just like a producer or musical artist who samples an old song and uses it as a bass track for a new song, Magritte took the classic nude torso, sliced it, and then used it in his own painting. The various objects in this work could have a ton of different meanings. Magritte painted the tripartite torso in several of his paintings and explained that he felt the torso was just a dream about the present. Each torso section represents a past generation. Maybe Magritte's saying that the torso and the painting itself are all about growth and progression. In the painting, the torso grows downward. Each section is bigger than the one above it. There are also other symbols of growth in the painting. The hovering blocks in the sky call to mind the building blocks we stacked as children, as well as the never-ending growth of buildings and cities. The candle could be used to light our way through the uncharted waters ahead. The painting seems to capture a nebulous place between the past and the future. There is nothing in the painting that roots us in the present, only surreal images that keep us floating somewhere between what has been and what will be. As teenagers, we are certainly familiar with the idea of growth and progression. Many of us have probably lost count of the number of times we've been told that we are the future. But when we hear statements like those alongside things like, the world is becoming scarier every day, and what's the world coming to? The fact that we are the future can be a bit daunting. It's hard to tell whether Magritte takes an optimistic or pessimistic view toward the future. The blocks in the heavens seem to tell us that the sky is no longer the limit, and the candle seems to say that we have the tools to light our way into the future. But The painting is called Delusions of Grandeur 2. Delusion implies something false, a misconception. Are we just lying to ourselves when we look at the future in an optimistic light? Is this view of the future too good to be true? The painting seems to hover not just between the past and the future, but also between optimism and pessimism about what's to come. But while we are sandwiched between the past and the future, we have no way of determining whether Magritte's painting is a prediction or a delusion. The only way to find out is to wait until the future becomes the present. You will move now from a fragmented body to an idealized one. To the left of Magritte's painting, you'll see a sculpture of a young girl reclining on a sofa. This work, completed in 1975, is called Girl on a Fainting Couch by Charlottesville-based artist Emily Kaufman. Both Rene Magritte and Emily Kaufman deal with the tension between the past and the future in their art. Kaufman's work is a memorial to the carefree, idealized beauty of youth. Her sculpture captures a young girl with no wrinkles, no broken hearts, and it seems, no cares in the world. She is young and in love. John Baldessari once said that as soon as you place two things together, you have a story. But what is the story between Rene Magritte's Delusions of Grandeur 2 and Kaufman's sculpture? I had the chance to talk with Emily Kaufman about Girl on a Fainting Couch and asked her what she thought about Magritte's painting and the juxtaposition Baldessari posed between Delusions of Grandeur 2 and Girl on a Fainting Couch. Speaking about the Magritte painting, she noted,
"Well, I guess, you know, the first thing you notice is it's a nude woman, and she is, you know, has a lot of different parts, but she has no head. And there's a candle here that may be trying to illuminate something, and there are clouds with buildings, and you think, well, what's happened to her head and her arms? It's like, what is her purpose in life? Yeah. You know, maybe he thought my piece was in a similar vein, you know, that she was a woman, you know, sort of an idealized body, but, you know, she looked like she was in love and not even thinking, you know, very much. But that's what first came to my mind, that she has no head and that my piece looks like she's in love and not even thinking about anything else. He may have wanted to just deal with pure form and the female form without having a personality. There's a lot of things going on with the face. If you can get rid of the face, sometimes it can be much more pure. And a lot of my pieces have their eyes closed just for that reason. It's like if you open the eyes, then you have to deal with their soul. And, you know, closing the eyes is sort of like taking the head off, I think.
By closing the girl's eyes, Kaufman places her in a blissful dream world. This dream world was not dissimilar to Kaufman's world at the time she created the piece. Kaufman explained that she completed Girl on a Fainting Couch when she was 23 and had just finished graduate school. She was idealistic, and as a result, the figures she sculpted were idealized.
I knew what I wanted to do then was to represent very youthful, beautiful, idealized bodies. And that always had to do with me and how I felt about my body. But now at this age, I just think, you know, how could I still think that?
Kaufman's sculpture is beautiful and dreamlike. But beauty fades and dreams end. The reason why beauty is prized is because it is fleeting. Wrinkles form, hearts break, responsibilities descend. Perhaps Kaufman's sculpture isn't so different from Magritte's painting. Both take place in a mystical, precarious dream world where it's impossible to stay for too long. Maybe the girl on the couch is imagining her own dreams, or delusions, of grandeur. But while we as viewers age and grow and change, and maybe become a little less idealistic and a little more pragmatic, the girl in Kaufman's sculpture will remain the same. She will be poised in love and beauty forever. So no matter how far we get from our young, romantic selves, Kaufman's sculpture will remind us how it felt to be young and in love. And maybe, for a second, make us feel that way again. Unlike Emily Kaufman, whose art is strongly rooted in beauty, the next artist you'll look at, Klaus Oldenburg, believed art was in trash cans, broken glass, and soda cans. You'll find his piece on the left wall of this gallery. It's a green and white 7-Up logo. As you approach the piece, listen to a statement Oldenburg wrote in 1961. I am for the art of underwear and the art of taxi cabs. I am for the art of ice cream cones dropped on concrete. I am for the majestic art of dog turds rising like cathedrals. I am for cool art, 7-Up art, Pepsi art, sunshine art, 39 cents art. Your first reaction may be that this guy sounds insane. He can't actually believe there's a majestic art in dog turd. But Klaus Oldenburg truly believed there was. Oldenburg's art is often classified as part of a movement known as pop art. Pop artists gleaned inspiration from images they saw on billboards, in magazines, and even in their refrigerators. They fully immersed themselves in popular culture and featured images we see every day, like 7-Up and Coca-Cola logos, in their art. Oldenburg once wrote that his objects are handles he reaches for to get his message across. The question is, what is the message in this work of art? Oldenburg featured this sculpture in a large show called The Store in 1961. He rented out a dining room furniture shop in New York City and filled the store with large muslin replicas of popular manufactured images like French fries, underwear, and of course, 7-Up. He sold the pieces for prices like $198.99. You might be wondering why Oldenburg would possibly make art that imitated consumer products. It doesn't make much sense that he would try to blend something that's supposed to be original and special with things that are by definition manufactured and mundane. But perhaps it's Oldenburg's way of commenting on society. Oldenburg often played with size to exaggerate significance. This 7-Up decal is certainly blown out of its usual proportion. Oldenburg may be making a statement about the importance, or prevalence, of manufactured goods like 7-Up in our sometimes materialistic, consumer-driven culture. But Oldenburg also said that he believed in 7-Up art. He saw art in practically every mundane object on the planet. The sculpture itself incorporates the aesthetics of the everyday. The splattered, dripped paint brings to mind billboards and graffiti, and the crumpled texture recalls street trash. Oldenburg seems to say that while our 7-Up cans contain elements of art, his artwork also contains elements of trash. He says there is art in trash and trash in art. For one of his first exhibitions, Oldenburg literally rifled through trash cans to find materials. His art dives into the space between art and trash and mixes everything up so that we aren't sure what qualifies as art and what qualifies as trash. And maybe that's Oldenburg's point. Sometimes, the space between art and trash and trash and art is just in our heads. So, the next time you pop open a can of 7-Up or step in a pile of dog poop, think of Oldenburg and see the art in it. You will find out what 7-Up and Playboy bunnies have in common when you move to the next work of art on this tour. Walk into the next gallery and stop at the first painting on your left. This painting is called Bunnies by German artist Sigmar Pohl. This painting, created in 1966, was based on a photograph of four Playboy bunnies, scantily clad hostesses at Hugh Hefner's Playboy Clubs for Men. Both Sigmar Polk and Klaus Oldenburg were inspired by images they saw in popular culture and used the images in their art in order to make some comment about society. While Oldenburg took on our mass consumerism in 7-Up, Polk takes a look at women in the media in Bunnies. Polk used Benday dots, a mechanical process that created images for commercial printing in most of his paintings between 1963 and 1969. By obscuring the bunnies with dots, Polk separates you from the pre-existing connotations you may have of the women in the painting. The dots emphasize the physical nature of an immediate image and take away the image's power to communicate its usual sexist message. The question is then, what message is Polk trying to communicate? Looking at the painting, you may once again find yourself in the space between. The curtain of dots places you in a state of limbo, where you can sort of see, but sort of not see, the bunnies in the painting. You can make out just enough to distinguish among them, and perhaps to tell if you find them attractive. Their costumes are reproduced in three different systems of dots, which makes it easier to differentiate them. But while you can see just enough to judge the women from the neck down, it's difficult to make out any discernible facial features. This, too, may be part of Polk's plan. As Emily Kaufman said, when you add visible eyes or a head to a figure, you give it a soul. Polk may have wanted the women to remain relatively anonymous, to mirror the way the bunnies, and many figures, are presented in the media. The slightly blurry or faraway images in the newspaper or on a billboard obscure the people pictured the same way the Benday dots obscure the bunnies. John Baldessari underscored Polk's social commentary by placing bunnies near Charles Webster Hawthorne's The Story and Martin Kippenberger's series of self-portraits. If you take a step back and look at the entire wall in front of you, you will see Hawthorne's painting on the far right and Kippenberger's works in the middle. Baldessari noted that Polk and Kippenberger made art in response to the kind of upper-class snobbery depicted in The Story. By placing bunnies and The Story together, Baldessari also set up a sort of playful dialogue between them. The men at the table seemed to be glancing over at the bunnies. Some of the bunnies return their gaze, while others coyly look away. The men in The Story see the bunnies as we all do. They are intriguing, but impossible to see clearly. Polk seems to say that no matter how closely we look at the images of people in pop culture, they will remain just that, images. You'll go from Playboy bunnies to a Playboy illustrator as you move to the next work of art on this tour. On the far wall of this gallery hangs a painting by Ed Paschke, a Chicago-based artist who supported himself at the beginning of his career by illustrating for Playboy magazine. The figure in the painting you are about to see is a far cry from a Playboy bunny, however. Can you find it? It is the bright painting of a garish-looking figure with heavy makeup and huge red hair on the left side of the far wall. As you approach this piece, what questions come to mind? Are you curious about who this person is? Whether the figure is male or female? Do you feel like a voyeur, looking at something you aren't really supposed to see? This painting, called Fifi, is one in a series created by Ed Paschke that was inspired by the nightlife and underground cultures of Chicago. During the early 1970s, Paschke would wander the streets by day and by night, rubbing shoulders with people most of us rarely interact with, but are often still fascinated by. Prostitutes, transvestites, nightclub entertainers. During his neighborhood jaunts, Paschke would frequently change clothes several times a night in order to fit in each locale. Paschke was influenced by the same pop art movement that Oldenburg and Polk are associated with. You can see traces of the pop aesthetic in Paschke's work, in the bright colors that recall neon signs, and the airbrush-style paint job that recalls magazine pages and street signs. What makes Paschke different from other pop artists, though, is that while most of them focused on stuff that took center stage in society, Paschke focused on the people in the wings. It's interesting, then, that Baldessari chose to place this piece in the corner of the room. Maybe the placement is meant to echo Fifi's place in society. and the fact that she is often forced to remain in shadowy corners. Paschke was interested in people on the societal fringes even as a teenager and young adult. In his late 20s, he worked as an aide at a psychiatric hospital, which he said left a great mark on my soul. Fifi's exaggerated facial expression and body language certainly owe something to this formative experience. Fifi's facial expression and hairstyle, which border on grotesque, are typical of the way we see the subjects in all of Paschke's paintings. We see them from afar, and because we do not know them, all we have are exaggerated perceptions. The garish, bright painting disguises Fifi, just as the dots disguise the Playboy bunnies in Polk's painting. Paschke explained that his goal was not to create realistic likenesses of the people he interacted with, but rather to make theatrical, imaginary portraits. The combination of Paschke's real-life experiences with his obviously dramatized paintings leads us into the space between what we think we know about these people and who they really are. Paschke's work forces us to confront our stereotypes and realize that we know neither glossy magazine models nor the underbelly of society the way we think we do. The last work of art you'll look at on this tour is by British sculptor Anish Kapoor. It's located in this gallery, in a portion of the room that John Baldessari called the Black Hole. This section of works examines big ideas, chiefly religion, life, and death. This section of the exhibit is on the left side of this gallery, in front of the entrance to the last room. It's hard to miss. There's a huge, dark blue circular sculpture in the corner. Other works in this corner may seem a little more overtly religious than Kapoor's. It isn't hard to figure out that the painting to your left, called Study for the Crucifixion by Thomas Eakins, has connections to religion, life, and death. Anish Kapoor's 1987 sculpture, called At the Hub of Things, requires a little more explanation. Even if it isn't explicitly religious upon first glance, the sculpture definitely possesses an immediately noticeable otherworldly component. Its powdery, velvety surface and the way it balances on the floor make it seem as if it belongs in a dream. As you walk around the front of the sculpture, do you notice anything interesting? Can you tell if it's flat or concave? If you crouch down, you may be able to make out the thin, feathered edges of the circle, which tell you that the sculpture is concave. The mystery inherent in this sculpture, and the fascination you might feel while examining it, are central to Kapoor's artistic vision. While artists like Magritte, Oldenburg, Paschke, and Polk made art to make you re-examine the way you look at society and your own life, Kapoor said art should make time stand still for a small moment. But this doesn't explain the sculpture's religious component. This sculpture was actually inspired by a trip Kapoor took in 1979 to India, where he was born. Kapoor was fascinated by the mounds of blue, yellow, and red pigments outside Hindu temples. The blue pigment represents Kali, a blue-skinned Hindu goddess. Also called the Destructive Mother, Kali gives life and takes it away. Kapoor's sculpture, covered with tactile blue pigment, was inspired by Kali. Kali is present not only in the blue color of the sculpture, but also in its shape. What does the shape remind you of? It can resemble forces of both birth and death, two things over which Kali is said to have divine control. The shape resembles a womb and a burial enclosure, a woman's breast and a bullet shell. The shape of the sculpture is reminiscent of both maternal, life-giving forces and destructive, life-ending forces. The title, At the Hub of Things, could refer to either force as well. This work of art exemplifies the idea of betweenness. The sculpture hovers somewhere between the two biggest forces we know, life and death. As a result, the sculpture feels not as much religious as it does spiritual. The fact that it expresses the space between life and death makes it relate to spirituality in general much more than any specific religion in particular. But the work manages to tie religion and spirituality, as well as life and death, together. Like many works in this exhibition, the more we look at the spaces between things, the smaller those spaces become.